Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the top experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's pioneering research started the national movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at developments in the banking industry, economics, and money itself, and we'll update you on developments on the public banking frontier. Our program is underwritten by Payment Management Merchant Credit Card Services at paymentmgmt.com.
It's a different world. It changed. Yeah. It changed when Clinton began bombing in Yugoslavia and Serbia. And it changed when he let them monopolize the media. He let five or six mega companies consolidate the entire independent media. You know, 90% of the American media now is owned by six companies. So there's no longer any independent media. They're run by corporate advertising executives and former government officials.
That's Paul Craig Roberts, our guest once again this week on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, as we hear the rest of his interview with Ellen that began on our last program. Hi, I'm Walt McCree. Paul Craig Roberts gives an unvarnished review of how different our world has become as an outspoken critic and observer of government, history, and American institutions. In this part of Ellen's conversation, Roberts provides bracing insights into what's going on around us in a world of opaque power centers and political illusions. As an assistant secretary to the Treasury with Ronald Reagan's administration, Paul has seen the world, our government, and the role of money and finance change into what he calls a new world. He looks back on how Wall Street influence has rolled over the ability of government to really serve public interests, how it has consolidated industries like media and banking, and has left us all susceptible to a grand plan designed to turn public assets of all types into mere financial instruments for payment of interest-bearing debt. So what happens when there's so much debt that there isn't enough spendable money to keep the wheels of the economy turning? Paul Craig Roberts tells Allen about economist Michael Hudson's notion that debt forgiveness, as it was done in ancient times, may be an answer.
You know, Michael Hudson says that another strategy used historically is just debt forgiveness. And this was true even in ancient lands like Assyria and Samaria, was that every certain number of years, it was just debt forgiveness because the debt levels had risen so high they couldn't be serviced, so they just started all over.
But I think there actually is. In fact, I was tempted to write a book called The Plot to Own the World, or Banker's Coup, The Plot to Own the World, which I think they actually intend to do. I mean, it looks like they actually literally want to own everything. I don't know who they are and if there's a great mastermind behind it or if it's just sort of greed driving a bunch of people, but still, it does look bleak out there.
Well, that's right. That's what Michael Hudson says as well. And he's written about this. And another way of looking at it is what they're trying to do is to convert the entire economic surplus into the payment of interest. In other words, anything created in the economy above the current standard of living, they want drained off into the payment of interest on debt.
Mm-hmm.
And so what this financialization of the economy is to convert all of any increase in output into fees for banks, interest on debt, service charges. In other words, no increase in consumption, no increase in investment, no increase in public services, just increase in financial profits.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
it's
if you're going to write that book, it's a good idea.
They're looking at sustainable. I mean, they're not reasonable. It's like the old emperors of ancient years knew that they had to give the people some money to keep the thing operating, but that doesn't seem to be the mentality today. It's not a mentality of what's going to make the economy run well. It's how can we grab it all?
That's right. That's right. That's the fundamental difference from my time in the Treasury and the time that followed the repeal of Glass-Steagall and the removal of position limits on speculators. All of that happened the last year of Clinton, first years of George W. Bush. And there's no continuity between Reagan and now. In fact, I would say there's really not any continuity between George Herbert Walker Bush and now. So we've had a new thing from the financial deregulation and the collapse of the Soviet Union. A new world has been created in which all the rules are different, the behavior of government's different, and who they serve is entirely different. Mm-hmm. See, even in the Reagan years, government was used by powerful private interest groups, but not entirely. Government could still do some things for people, for the social system. Not anymore. It serves about six powerful interest groups, and that's it. So, you know, the thing about the left wing, they hate Reagan so much that they cause a tremendous confusion because they blame everything that's happened today on Reagan. It's nothing to do with it. It's a different world.
That's what I wanted to get out from you, because I that's my sense, that we're blaming the wrong.
Yeah, we're blaming the
wrong.
Something
happened in there that we're not focusing on. That
it's a different world. It changed.
Yeah.
It changed when Clinton began bombing in Yugoslavia and Serbia. And it changed when he let them monopolize the media. You know, that's another thing that happened. He let five or six mega companies consolidate the entire independent media. You know, 90% of the American media now is owned by six companies. So there's no longer any independent media.
Mm-hmm.
They're run by corporate advertising executives and former government officials. You may have seen that article the other day on Global Research where the former political editor of the Telegraph in London said, I resign because our advertisers control what the paper can publish.
Wow. Yeah. Well, and I wonder if it was even Clinton. It seems more like they caught him with Monica Lewinsky, and then
they may have planted her on him.
Yeah, I wouldn't doubt, or at least
I mean, everyone knew he had a weakness for women.
Right, I read a biography. Apparently, he had hundreds of women.
Yeah.
So they could catch him many different ways.
But it doesn't matter.
Fact,
what happened is it happened under his watch. We lost the independence of the media. We lost financial regulation. And with the Soviet collapse,
mm-hmm.
we lost the only constraint on power in the United States. So everything has happened since is happening in a new world, totally new world, totally different conditions than what was there before. Totally different behavior patterns,
mm-hmm.
both of government and of business.
I even read that when after Reagan was shot, that he was more, whatever, you know, not didn't fight as much, or I don't know how to put it, but it seems to me they capture all presidents in one way or another. If they have to, they shoot them outright, like Kennedy.
Like Kennedy, yeah. Well, we, you know, the Reagan people in the government often wondered about that. We kind of.
I mean, I don't think the presidents are in control. In fact, even I remember reading that Clinton said somewhere about something like, "Gee, I thought that when I got to be president, I'd be making the decisions or something."
Yeah, no, they're not, Ellen, unless they have something of a movement behind them.
Like,
you know, Goldwater
Roosevelt
had a movement. He didn't make it to the presidency. Reagan had less of a movement, but he had something. And so he had two big goals, to cure stagflation, to end the Cold War. That's really all he was interested in. And he achieved both. And he achieved them despite the fact that Wall Street was against his economic program. Wall Street saw the reduction in marginal tax rates in the traditional Keynesian terms as a stimulus to consumer demand. And they said, look, the inflation's already 10%. You've come into office inheriting 10%, and you're going to cut taxes. It's going to drive it higher. It will ruin our stock and bond portfolios. Interest rates will go up. Bond prices will fall. The stock market will fall. You mustn't do this. It'll hurt us. I don't know how many times I had people from Wall Street in my office explain to me, where are you people? Crazy? You're going to do this? And I said, no, you don't understand the policy. Let me explain the policy. But they're so brainwashed by what they learned in school all their life and have read in the Wall Street Journal all their life that it just didn't take. We had the same trouble with Paul Volcker. We met with him every Monday morning. He'd call the treasurer for breakfast, and we would sit down and we'd say, Paul, look, this is what we're trying to do. It requires your corporation. As the tax cuts phase in, we want you to gradually reduce the rate of growth in money and credit. We don't want you to turn it off. We don't want you to stop it. We just want you to slow it down as the tax cuts phase in, because as they phase in, there'll be more response of output, and you won't have to rely entirely on demand pressure. And that demand pressure is what forces up the inflation rate. Well, he couldn't understand it either. And I would go to the meetings with Volcker, with his outside economic advisors, all these prestigious economists, because I was the Treasury representative at the meetings. I was an observer. I wasn't allowed to speak, but I could watch. And they all told him, they said, oh, Paul, this is an inflationary policy. And they said, this is what Alan Greenspan told him. Monetary policy is the weak sister. They still used sexist language in those days. It's the weak sister. At best, it can conduct a weak rearguard action. No matter how tight your monetary policy, the fiscal policy of this administration is going to cause inflation to explode. And then Volcker got concerned that he'd be blamed. And he said, well, if there's no money growth, they can't blame me for causing inflation. So he went home to the Fed and turned the money off. And that's what caused that sudden depression. That's what made the deficit so big. Anytime the economy goes in recession, the deficits mount. And in the meantime, the Bush people in the Reagan administration had made a deal with Bob Dole and the Republicans in the Senate to phase in the tax cuts over 3 years. And the first year was only 5%. So that was wiped out by the inflation. So you got no input from the fiscal policy because they phased it in, and you got no cooperation from the Fed, who instead of just gradually reducing the growth of money and credit to a more even level, which would let output expand but not prices, he just turns the money off. So despite these massive failures, the policy still worked. Under Reagan and Clinton, we had almost a two-decade boom, and we did not have to pay for it with rising rates of inflation. This was a new thing, first time. The Phillips curve just disappeared. The Phillips curve was the Keynesian explanation for why the employment and inflation trade-off was worsening. The Reagan years, and this is just statistically, the fact, the Reagan years, you see a rise in economic growth while inflation falls. And the American economy had not experienced that in decades. So our policy worked. And that's all Reagan really cared for. Now, to get that policy out of the administration, I had to fight tooth and nail against the Bush people who were in league with the Wall Street. Not for any nefarious reason, but just because they believed the same old crap that everybody else believed. They weren't part of the change. So I had to fight Jim Baker, David Stockman, Larry Kudlow. It was a messy thing. And then the same thing with ending the Cold War. The CIA was totally opposed. So was the military security complex. They said, what do you mean in the Cold War? You're going to ruin our budgets, our power. What are we going to do if it's not a Soviet threat? How are we going to spend all this money on planes and ships and guns and rockets and missiles?
They actually said that?
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, this was... And they told Reagan, you know, Reagan said that we're going to, he outlined his policy. I had left the Treasury, but he outlined his policy. And they said, well, you can't do this, Mr. President. They'll win. The Soviets will win the arms race. If you start an arms race, they'll win. And he said, what do you mean? How can they do? They don't even have any coming. Oh, you don't understand, Mr. President. The Soviets have a planned economy. They control investment. They can put the entire economy into the military. You can't do that. The American people won't let you do that. You can't possibly match the Soviets' ability to commit resources to the military. They have a planned economy. They control investment. And so they had him flummoxed. And so what he did, he created a secret committee and put me on it. And we had subpoena power over the CIA. We could call in anybody, any document. We could call the director in and depose him. And if it didn't cooperate, they were instantly fired. And so our job was to study the basis for the CIA's conclusion and come back and tell the president, is this true or not? And the conclusion was that it was not, that the CIA was acting in a defensive way protecting its turf. It wanted the Cold War, needed it.
You have to wonder if that's not what's happening now, too. I mean, the military is half the government, so of course they want
to. Sure, it's always happening. It's always happening, Ellen, always. And so,
I think that's the reason China does so well. They have a controlled economy, which they can direct towards supporting their industries. So we don't support our industries. In fact, we hamstring our industries.
No, we let Wall Street drive it offshore for profits.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You see, people don't understand this, but the allegedly authoritarian government in China is far more concerned with the public interest of the Chinese people than the so-called democratic government in America.
Yeah.
All we're concerned about is profits.
Right.
And the Chinese are concerned about social stability. We got to get these people better off. If we don't, in this social instability, the Americans are going to do us over. And it's the same in Russia. If you look at the policies of the Russian government, they're actually directed to improve the situation for the people, not for the rich.
Right.
There's this huge difference, and people just... But the propaganda is so extreme against Russia and against China, and they don't have any way to answer. They don't have... Those languages are impenetrable, and they don't have... You know, English is the world language, so we control the explanations. So we can go shoot somebody and say Putin did it, and there's nothing can be done. We weren't supposed to talk about the secret committee, but it was so long ago.
Uh-huh.
The Soviet Union, and I didn't talk about it, but it's so long ago. The Soviet Union's gone, Reagan's gone, the whole issue is gone. All it is an illustration that Reagan had two goals and he had to fight to achieve them. But he did, despite the opposition. You know, I described why Wall Street was opposed to the economic program and why the military security complex was opposed to ending the Cold War. And it's probably why they're starting it back. Or using the neocons' ideology to start it back. You see, now it's much more dangerous because we didn't have the neocon ideology during the Reagan period. We had some neocons, they weren't in the kind of high positions that they subsequently got into. And the ideology hadn't come to fruition because the Soviet Union hadn't collapsed. Mm-hmm. And so they didn't know we were a unipower. And they couldn't talk about hegemony. So it's worse now. And, of course, the military security complex, they got rescued by the war on terror and all those wars in the Middle East for 14 years now. Seven countries bombed the smithereens. This has been good for the budgets. But, it seems to be running out.
Right.
But Russia, to get a new Cold War with Russia, oh, that's big deal. That's big money. And Russia is much more scary to Americans than these little countries. They don't even know where they are. So, yes, that's the world that we live in. And the propaganda is incessant. And the other big difference is the media is now owned lock, stock, and barrel by the government. The value of those big media companies is their federal broadcast licenses. So they get on the wrong side of the government, and a multi-billion-dollar company is worth zero.
Right.
And they also can't go against the corporate advertisers or the
right.
interest of the corporate advertisers.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Well, thank God we have the alternative media.
The alternative media is for intelligent, aware people. The policymakers don't pay attention to it. It has no impact whatsoever on Congress or the White House.
Right. I ran for state treasurer, and I could see that if you couldn't get on TV, there was absolutely no way you were going to win any kind of election because most people get their news from TV.
That's right. Yeah, the alternative media is important for the thinking population, and that's never a very large percentage. It's important because, like Margaret Mead said, it only takes a few determined people to change the world. And that's sometimes true. Not always, but it's sometimes true. So that's why I keep going. I think the hopes are in collapse of the dollar, which will greatly reduce American power in the world, and in the development of new trade and payment mechanisms that separate important parts of the world off from the Western-dominated one. And this, too, will limit American power. I think the unipolar world, I think it's over now because, in my own opinion, unless the Russians and Chinese make amazing strategic mistakes, I don't think the United States is a match for the combination of Russia and China. But, of course...
What were the new payment systems you're talking about?
Russia and China and other countries are moving away from the use of the dollar in international payments. They're now transacting in their own currencies.
Right.
And they're moving huge amounts of the oil business out of the dollar. So the so-called petrodollar is being abandoned.
Mm-hmm.
And Russia is now creating an alternative to the SWIFT payment system that's currently like a world system that the Americans run.
Mm-hmm.
So when you see trade transacted in currencies that are not dollars, then the demand for dollar in the currency markets falls because they're not using it to make payments.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's hard to keep the value of the dollar up if its use in the world payment system is falling. See, right now we do it because we've got the Japanese central bank printing money faster than we do, and we've got the European central bank printing money faster than we do. You know, the Japanese quantitative easing is much greater than what the Fed did. And the European Central Bank is currently printing 60 billion euros a month. So if the other two large fiat currencies are printing at these rates, then it sustains the dollar's value. But over time, if larger and larger percentages of energy resources are not traded in dollars. If Russia is not doing its agricultural business in dollars, consumer good business in dollars, yeah, the same with China, the same with India, Brazil, South Africa. More and more countries will be drawn into that, and the use of the dollar will continue to plummet. And so the ability to keep the dollar's value up by inflating the other large currencies goes away. And in the meantime, those countries in the BRICS system, they all, of course, have an incentive to keep their currency stable. They go up in value. So that, I think, is what will eventually force change here, because the elites will be discredited by failure. I don't think we can budge them with arguments. They don't care.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we can affect them. What we can do is educate the important part of the population that thinks. So when the opportunity arises, they'll know what to do.
Right.
So when
yeah,
they get an opportunity to correct the situation, they can adopt your plan.
Yeah, oh, great. Yeah, that's my thought, is that we've got to get information out there so that people know they don't have to succumb to this police state when it comes to that, that there's another option.
I don't think they can do anything until the elites have failed. You know,
mm-hmm.
the economic collapse, political defeat abroad, you know, if as we said earlier, if the Russians and the Chinese could pry Greece out of the EU, this would begin the unraveling of NATO.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the Eastern European countries would fall, Hungary would fall. And so you would see the empire, instead of expanding, it would be contracting and unraveling, and that makes it harder and harder for all the manipulations that are currently underway, you know, the gold price, the stock price, the bond price, the dollar
mm-hmm.
price, all that's a house of cards. And it requires the image of American might and superiority, and so no one wants to test it. I mean, everybody might know it's a house of cards, but they're not going to test it because there's all this unipower behind it. So I think that's how the change comes, Ellen, that the elites go too far, they're too greedy, they're too arrogant, they're too full of hubris, they overreach, they produce reactions they can't control, they fail, they get discredited, collapse, and that gives a chance to make a comeback. And I think that's what your job, my job, is. People understand what the alternatives are to the mess that they ended up in.
Well, that ended on a positive note after all. Okay, yeah, definitely. I'd love to talk to you again. Thank you so much.
That was Ellen Brown talking with renowned columnist and former Reagan administration advisor Paul Craig Roberts. Ellen and I continued with a conversation about the topic of her latest article on Greece and how the consolidated financial powers of the EU, IMF, and the European Central Bank are all threatening to strangle Greece now that its newly elected government has unequivocally renounced the austerity that was imposed on it by European and American bankers. I asked her what she thought about his assessment that the moneyed elite were leading us to the brink of destruction and that things were going to fall apart before too long.
He always says that, though. You know, he's been, there are a number of them that have been saying that for years. I mean, I've been saying it, too. Things have to collapse, but they don't seem to. It's strange.
But in the case of Greece, here you have a situation where...
They're forcing it into collapse. Yep.
Yeah.
My latest article, which should be out by Wednesday, is on the fact that the ECB is, in fact, using that very extortion tool that was threatened in December when I wrote an article in early January about how Goldman Sachs had written a memo to the Greek parliament basically right. saying that the risk that they ran by not electing their austerity candidate was that liquidity might be cut off by the central bank, not because there was anything wrong with the Greek banks, or at least not before their liquidity was cut off, but just because in the turmoil, et cetera, the implication was that just might happen. Well, why would it happen? Obviously, as an extortion measure, and that's exactly what happened. As soon as the Syriza party, Tsipras, the current prime minister, who's the yeah. head of the Syriza party, as soon as he got elected at the end of January, like the next week, the central bank said that they were not going to accept Greek bonds as collateral for their liquidity window, which, as if, you know, this is some sort of emergency thing, but all banks need that. You cannot stay afloat as a bank without having access to the central bank window, because that's just the way banking works today. All banks lend money they don't have, and if the borrowers and the depositors come for their money at the same time, then the bank will borrow it from somewhere else. So they can borrow it from other banks, assuming the other banks have it. But if they're trying to extend credit, if they're trying to expand the credit in the system, then there aren't going to be enough reserves to borrow. So that's where the central bank, in our case the Federal Reserve, would step in and would sell some bonds, and that would create some money onto the books of the banks and then into their reserve accounts, and then they could use that as reserves for these additional loans or whatever, the additional demands on their liquidity. So all banks need that. This is a function of the central bank. This is why we have central banks. I mean, this is the reason the Federal Reserve was put in 1913, because before that, the banks routinely went bankrupt. I think I read that every 7 years on average during the 19th century, there would be a massive panic and bank run, and then the banks would close their doors and people would lose their farms, and you know, they go into a depression. So they had this roller coaster of booms and busts and booms and busts, and so finally there was a massive panic in 1907, which some people say was actually triggered by J.P. Morgan. But anyway, J.P. Morgan stepped in with all this money that who knows where he got it. It looks like it came from Europe, in other words, from the Rothschild bankers, who were his cronies, and stepped in, saved the banks, and then the Rockefeller and Morgan met, and their people met and cooked up this plan for a central bank, which was the Federal Reserve, which is modeled on the Bank of England. So I'm sure it wasn't an original plan. The intent was to model it on the Bank of England, make it a private central bank that would backstop the other banks. So that's what a central bank does.
Yeah.
And for the ECB to say, you run the risk that we're going to turn off the spigot, is sheer extortion. And
right.
they actually did it.
And it's an immoral threat. I mean, it's like in Detroit, where they shut off the water to people who couldn't afford water, you know, couldn't afford to pay the dollars for the service of having this life-supporting liquid. The central bank is that spigot for
right, they're turning off our money that we need to survive, exactly. Yeah, so the Greek people are being the ones that are being made to suffer. Now, at the moment, their banks can still get liquidity, but it's from this emergency lending window type thing.
Which is pretty high interest, right?
Yeah, it's more expensive, and the ECB has threatened to cut that off, too. And, in fact, in the case of Cyprus, that's what they did. They said that they would cut off the emergency loans within a matter of days, unless the government agreed to the Troika's austerity plan.
Yeah, so
and in
the
Ireland, too.
So that the EU strategy is to put all of these countries under the control of the central banking spigot that feeds their economies. And if the bankers who run the ECB, the European Central Bank, who are largely from Goldman Sachs, right?
Well, the head is definitely Mario Draghi.
Mario
was
Draghi,
head of Goldman Sachs, or head of one department of Goldman Sachs International before he headed.
So they're able to exercise these global strategies around controlling the lifeblood and the operations, the economies of all these countries. Now, the cool thing is that the Greeks seem to, you know, have a little bit of chutzpah going on, say, hey, you know, sue us then. You know, we'll talk. The Russians want to talk to us, and we may have an option here. They seem to be playing it pretty cool at this point.
Well, so far I think they've gone along with the demands, but the finance minister, whose name I can't pronounce, has said that. I mean, he did it in obscure language so that they think they can get around it. But my sense is that they're just playing for time, and that, I mean, it seems to me they really don't want to leave the Eurozone, and they won't if they can avoid it. But there are, I've seen all kinds of proposals for how they could expand their own internal money supply and still stay in the Eurozone. Use their euros to pay off the debt like they're supposed to. But meanwhile, let their public banks issue credit, but then they need the ECB to back up that credit. Or, you know, there are all sorts of different systems where you could, or advance tax credits, or just different forms of money or near money, things that aren't really money but that would trade in the economy, credits against money owed, you know, just sort of like credits, issue credits on their future pay that they can then trade in the community.
When you were in Ireland talking with them about the idea of creating public banks there, even though they're inside the ECB hold, if they created a public bank, they would be able to borrow from the ECB underneath the Maastricht Treaty's provisions, right?
Right. Banks, just like the private banks, can use the, I think the loan is down to, is it 1% now? They're not down to 0.25% like here, but pretty low anyway.
Yeah. So that's one possible way that the Greeks could engineer themselves out while staying in the EU. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, what if Germany et al. Says, well, no, I'm sorry, this is our deal, and you'll take it or you'll, you know, we'll break you, and they march on?
That's what they have sort of said. I mean, apparently there's a rift between the Troika is now 2-1. It's now the EU part of it. The EU Commission part wants to work things out. They want to negotiate. But the IMF and the ECB are the hardliners. And, of course, you know who those are. Those are the bankers.
Mm-hmm.
And specifically, the ECB is Goldman Sachs and, you know, those big international banks, not just your ordinary local bank wanting his money back.
Is there any logic or prospect to the idea that the Greeks could just say, well, back with you guys, we're going to reissue the drachma and deal with ourselves and anybody will play with us?
Well, that's certainly what a lot of people are rooting for, and what they could then do, and in fact what Paul Craig Roberts has suggested, is that they could borrow from Russia. They should borrow from Russia. They're right there. It would be a good deal for them.
Mm-hmm.
But the concern, what everybody's worried about, is that the drachma would immediately get devalued, if nothing else, by speculators, short sellers. But what they can do then is put on currency controls. That's the same thing they did in Malaysia when they had that threat in 1998, and it worked. Mm-hmm. And Russia has done it, put on currency controls. So I saw a thing by Goldman Sachs. It was an article by Goldman Sachs saying the reason they shouldn't do it is this, that, and the other. And one of their bogus reasons was, where are they going to get the money to print the bills and the coins? And then they were calculating how much that would cost. Well, you don't have to print the bills and the coins. All you have to do is credit cards or some other form of, you know, it's just credits. So just issue some credits.
Paul Craig Roberts was talking about, you know, the BRIC banks and the consolidation of the Russian and the Chinese dollars moving away, devaluing or moving away from the American petrodollar. That really is the shift in a new world financial order, isn't it? Where America is siding with the big banking interests that have not been serving the public interest, and the people are now starting to walk, or at least look elsewhere, for a way to build their economies and to live. Is this the start of what Robert says is the failure of the elites to serve the people that might be the break for us as citizens of the world to want to make things work better?
Well, it certainly seems like we're heading that way. I think that's why we're seeing these sort of blatantly extortionate measures, because that's the only way they can maintain their control, and they're still losing control. All the center banks are doing quantitative easing sort of competitively, and it's a race to the bottom and so forth. So something does have to give. Something has to be worked out. But it seems like when change happens, it's usually in a crisis.
so we may have
to undergo some sort of crisis before we can get a good system.
Well, I think we're starting to see that inside the U.S. as well, where the banks are now where people are starting to discover how much extraction and the banks have done from our municipalities, that they have over $4 trillion of municipal money, and that we're spending trillions of dollars every year in just expenses to Wall Street, to go to Wall Street directly. Well, people, you know, are seeing, hey, look, you know, I don't have a job, lost my house, I can't afford to complete my education. This is a failure of the system that seems to be really multiplying.
Yeah. Well, and that's sort of our job, is to point that out, because if you read the major media or you watch ordinary news, you won't hear that. I mean, my mother watches news all the time. She's 95, and there's nothing else to do over there. And it's all about, you know, some car accident or some robbery or some, you know, small things. Nobody talks about what's wrong with the economy. Certainly nobody talks about what crooks the big banks are and how we're being ripped off in fees with whatever, like our universities, et cetera, being ripped off by Wall Street.
But I really appreciate your adding these extra thoughts to what was a really interesting conversation you had with Paul. And it's very interesting to see how he says this is a new world. You know, when I was with the Reagan administration, there were predictable and reasonable roles that government would play in support of people's interests. But now, he said, they don't care. And this is where we are now in this kind of this new world. It's good we've got public banking to maybe build or go toward, huh?
Yeah, totally.
Well, thanks, Ellen.
Sure. Great talking to you.
And now we're happy to introduce you to a new voice here on It's Our Money, Matt Stannard. Matt is an economic justice advocate and works in political, media, and legal channels to help accelerate the process of democratizing our economy. He's doing that in his work with the Public Banking Institute by helping spread the public banking message through the media and in support of the local public banking groups around the country. Welcome to the show, Matt.
Thanks, Walt. I want to talk to you for a few minutes about what the economic justice movement is, what issues confront our fellow citizens when they're left without access to the commonwealth, and why we are now in a new position to change these chronic inequities for good. The objectives of a new economy, such as fairness, opportunity, and new efficiencies, require financing. And that financing needs to be managed democratically. Today's movement for creating public banks is a big step in that direction. Public banks are run by local or state governments without shareholders, with a mandate to support local community banks and fund public goods like schools, city services, and small businesses. Wall Street hates public banks because they demonstrate that local governments and communities can manage their money and finance their services without making massive interest payments to big banks. Local communities need public banks because they can return profits to the municipality as non-tax revenue. That boosts the financial strength of a community while easing budgetary constraints. They can help provide reliable and affordable credit that enables more economic development, like creating jobs, growing the tax base, making enormous savings in the cost of public works. In other words, public banks put their money where the people want the money to go. They can be directed to projects and public goods that the local or state community deem important. As you probably know, there's only one public bank in the United States today, in North Dakota, where this technology is in action. But the movement to create new public banks is growing rapidly in over 20 states and many more municipalities. With the fervor of commitment to humanize the economic justice landscape, citizens have joined together, and through persistent organizing, meetings, conversations, and a belief that democracy must be materialized, impressive strides are being made in the campaign to bring public banks to the United States. So why is North Dakota the only state in the union with a public bank? Because the big banks get very scared and they pay people to tell us that public banking won't work. The big banks hire lobbyists and think tanks, or they lure community bankers with promises of growth and partnership with the big banks to make spurious arguments about so-called government-run banks. And they need to keep that propaganda mill running because they know that the Bank of North Dakota has outperformed big Wall Street banks for years, as reported late last year in the Wall Street Journal. Called the BND, the Bank of North Dakota, more profitable than Goldman Sachs Group Incorporated, a better credit rating than J.P. Morgan Chase and Company, hasn't seen a profit growth drop since 2003, the Wall Street Journal said. The list of superlatives of public bank performance over Wall Street behemoths goes on and on. You get the picture. Wall Street can't compete with Main Street when Main Street runs the bank. Here's how Ellen Brown puts that difference. The answer is something the privately owned major media have tried to sweep under the rug. The public banking model is simply more profitable and efficient than the private model. Profits, rather than being siphoned off into offshore tax havens, are recycled back into the bank, the state, and the community. The BND's costs are extremely low, no exorbitantly paid executives, no bonuses, fees, or commissions, only one branch office, very low borrowing costs, no FDIC premiums. The state, rather than the FDIC, guarantees its deposits. These are all features that set publicly owned banks apart from privately owned banks. Beyond that, they are safer for depositors, allow public infrastructure costs to be cut in half, and provide a non-criminal alternative to Wall Street cartel caught in a laundry list of frauds. Those are the words of Ellen Brown. So it's unsurprising that in spite of Wall Street propaganda, cities and states all over the country are taking up the cause of public banking. Let's take a look at what's going on around the country. Perhaps one of the most exciting focal points is Seattle, where last fall the city council passed a revolutionary budget plan that emphasizes social services and community revitalization. Their city budget incorporates the moral responsibilities and objectives that all cities should pursue, helping to finance and secure affordable housing, provide financing to take strong action to help the homeless, open new lines of credit for local investment, and so forth. In other words, the tip of the spear of economic justice. In this very clear example, we see how public banks allow local citizens to impact local concerns, including the well-being of those left out. And so Seattle is pursuing a public bank. Arizona is hot too, and not just the weather. On February 18th in Arizona, SB 1395 to create a public bank task force and feasibility study passed the Senate Financial Service Committee. The vote was 6-0 with one abstention. The vote had GOP support. This transpartisan initiative, with support coming from both sides of the political spectrum, arose because Wall Street banks have been cutting off and closing down border town banking to the agricultural companies and families that have been operating in Arizona for years. The state legislature sees the threat and realize they would not have had this problem if they owned their own bank. In Maine, the legislature is considering LD 24, legislation that would set up a bank and allow the implementation of county and city banks. A few weeks ago, Diane Russell, a state representative and a widely recognized young politician nationally, gave a moving speech before the Maine Committee on Insurance and Finance and made a very direct challenge to her colleagues about owning their own bank, in which she called upon the legislators in that state to be bold and act on behalf of working people to set up a bank. You can read more about Maine and about Representative Russell on the Public Banking Institute blog. Then there's New Mexico, where, as our supporters know, the Public Banking Institute played an important role in organizing and presenting a region-wide conference at the urging of Mayor Javier Gonzalez, who identified the problem of city finance relative to big bank indifference and costs that have curtailed development of key city objectives, such as a municipally based Wi-Fi system, for example. We're happy to report that Santa Fe is making good progress in their pursuit of a public bank. On January 28th of this year, the City Council voted to approve a feasibility study for such a bank. And then there is Colorful Colorado, where citizens have been campaigning for public banks at the state and city levels since at least 2011. That movement has now taken off in full force. On January 31st of this year, the group Be the Change USA sponsored a public banking conference with more than 120 attendees, moderated by Denver city officials and community bankers, and featuring speakers such as our own Ellen Brown, Mike Krause, Gwen Hallsmith, Nomi Prince. In an op-ed at the Denver Post, Be the Change USA co-director Earl Stalen described the needs and issues driving their movement. He wrote, "Colorado enterprises seeking green energy solutions and small businesses startups scramble for funding. Needed infrastructure projects like repairing our state bridges are not keeping up with civil engineers' recommendations. Meanwhile, the marijuana industry in Colorado has no place to bank its cash. A bank here in Colorado working together with our locally owned community banks is a promising option for expanding real prosperity and well-being here. It would be required to lend in Colorado. Its mission would not include paying commissions or bonuses, making risky investments in its subprime loans or derivatives, or profiting at the expense of our community. A public bank's mission would be to serve our communities by helping them thrive and our citizens prosper. Through supporting small and medium-sized businesses, green energy, lower student debt, reduced home foreclosures, sustainable farming, infrastructure, and more. Elsewhere in Colorado, the Boulder public banking movement is focusing on how public banks can fund renewable clean energy. Boulder, you see, has $269 million in reserve funds. Supporters believe that if $25 million of that were deployed to set up a bank, that would get the bank $250 million in loan credits, enough to municipalize Boulder's electric utility. And now even Hawaii is returning to the stage to create a state-owned bank to assist homeowners who are having trouble making their mortgage payments, according to reporter Jason Ube of the Pacific Business News. What makes these efforts fresh and new, what makes them unique, is that this isn't Robin Hood politics. This isn't taking from the rich, forced redistribution, whatever you want to call it. This is wholly different economic thinking. It is democratic wealth creation, not the tenuous redistribution likely to be opposed by those in power. The heart of creating a financial system that has justice and fairness built in for the interests of the people, not just the private money lenders. In the coming programs, we're going to be delving deeper into the issues and concerns of these citizens around the country who are in the process of building the new economy. There are many stories to tell and serious work to be done. We invite you to find out more about it by visiting the Public Banking Institute website, that's publicbankinginstitute.org, and by following us on Facebook and Twitter and spreading the word that public banks are the key to recovering our democracy. After all, it is our money. This is Matt Standard.
Well, before we close up today, I wanted to share a story that I just came across a few days ago about what having a public bank allows states to even consider that they wouldn't otherwise consider. So the story goes back to, where else, North Dakota, where the state legislature was considering a Senate bill that was written to require the state bank, the Bank of North Dakota, to create a $5,000 account for every baby that is born into the state after the 1st of January of 2017. In other words, North Dakota was considering creating a nest egg for its new citizens so that as they grow up, they would have access to the money they need to pay for school, to start a business, for farm loan, and so forth. So the bill was to study how feasible it is to pursue this idea. The sponsor of it, Senator Ole Larson, says that the bill combines common sense with vision and helps everyone get a fair start in life. It was written to require the Bank of North Dakota to create a $5,000 account for every new baby, and that would grow by the age of 20 to about $20,000. All the unused money in the program would be going back into the state's general fund. The Senate approved the bill with an amendment to study the desirability and feasibility of the idea before it gets implemented. But here you have an example of the kind of remarkable potential that's afforded municipal and government leaders who are ostensibly interested in the welfare and future of citizens and looking at leveraging commonwealth of the state on behalf of these new citizens. I was just struck by how different that story is from the constant cries of debt and inadequacy, insufficiency for things, even including pension fund commitments that have been raided to pay for Wall Street investments and other debt obligations. Just the very idea of this is another kudo for the state of North Dakota and for having a public bank, which already provides students 1% college loans and where you can get a small business loan for 1% for 5 years if you qualify and you've got a reasonable business plan. Of course, the point is obvious. There are so many things that a community could do to look after the well-being of the community at large if it had the resources, the financial flexibility, and depth to be able to address some of the needs that people typically have, rather than having to cut services and raise taxes and sell off assets. The public bank in North Dakota has demonstrated yet again that it's able to not only serve the needs of the people today, but also to build a prospect for much better days to come. Well, that's it for this week's edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests and to our sponsor, Payment Management, a merchant payment processing company dedicated to economic fairness and justice. Payment Management invites you to receive a free analysis of your card processing needs and costs. More information is available at paymentmgmt.com. Be sure to stay in touch with the ongoing conversations around what's going on in our world of money by reading Ellen's blog at ellenbrown.com. And to learn more about public banking and how you can participate, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. Thanks for listening. For Ellen Brown, I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money, Ellen Brown.